The race to put computer chips into human brains is hotting up. The Australian-founded company Synchron is developing technology to allow users to control a computer using their thoughts via a BCI, or brain-computer interface. The Australian Federal Government's National Reconstruction Fund recently invested $54 million in Synchron. There's also, of course, Elon Musk's neurotech startup Neuralink. But the road to tech innovation and commercial success inevitably sees many businesses and products fall by the wayside. So what happens to patients if the business that makes a device installed in them stops producing component parts or servicing their technology or just goes out of business altogether? That's one of the many ethical questions that neuroscientist and bioethicist Dr. Gabriel Lázaro-Muñoz has looked into. Gabriel's from the Harvard Medical School Center for Bioethics, and he says that we need to look at a way to minimize the harms that patients will endure because of product or business failures. Recently, UNESCO adopted a recommendation on the ethics of neurotechnology. It's been described as the first global normative instrument on the ethics of neurotechnology. But in adopting it, UNESCO noted that medical use of neurotechnology is strictly regulated, but it remains largely unregulated in other areas. Dr. Gabriel Lázaro-Muñoz, welcome to Sunday Extra.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Now, I mentioned Synchron and Neuralink in the introduction, but neural technology is really quite old. It's been happening for a while. What are some of the oldest and most commonly used forms of technology in this space?
A lot of the devices, a lot of the products that we're seeing now being tested, like Synchron, StentCode, and Neuralink's brain-computer interface, are building upon technology and knowledge about the brain that has been developed for many years. For example, using BlackRock's Utah Array, which is a device that has been used in research actually at Mass General Brigham. Dr. Lee Hochberg has been one of the pioneers of this kind of research to help individuals with paralysis regain certain functions such as moving a cursor, being able to even write certain letters, and even being able to speak. So for patients that have dysarthria or difficulty with the muscles associated with speech, they can actually use these devices where you implant the neural device close to the motor cortex, and you can pick up the neural activity associated with what the patient is trying to say, so the intended speech, and decode that brain activity and actually project what the person is trying to say. And in fact, use AI to produce the voice, even with a recording that, you know, the patient's voice. So it's really interesting, yeah. And it's been built upon that technology, upon the, you know, the Utah Array and some of these other older technologies. Even deep brain stimulation is another one that has been used for over 25 years for movement disorders and epilepsy. So there's a relatively, I would say, longer history than one expects when you hear about these new companies coming out.
Yes, and Australia has a close association with the development of the cochlear implant, which has now been around for many decades. But along the way, as I mentioned, there are many attempts to innovate and businesses founded upon that that don't always succeed. Are you aware of examples where people have been left with, if you like, obsolete implants in their bodies and really struggling with how to deal with the position they're left in?
There have been a couple of, I would say, classic examples. You know, as recent as 2022, we saw Second Sight, a company that produced a retinal implant. They went out of business and they sold the intellectual property to another company. There were about 300 patients implanted with these devices, with these retinal implants. And when they started having issues with the functioning of the device needs maintenance, you know, it could be battery replacements, it could be software, it may be the hardware that you need to fix, some parts may break. So these devices are devices that just require quite a bit of maintenance, and this can be relatively expensive. So it puts patients in a very difficult position once the trials are over. So in Second Sight's case, you know, there were about more than 350 patients that were blind, and these retinal implants were helping them see certain sort of profiles and certain lights that could help them distinguish shapes and allow them to, you know, facilitate walking, facilitate moving around their house, etc. And they, you know, did not have access. Once the company went out of business, they didn't have access to the hardware and the software necessary to maintain the device. There's been other cases like NeuroVista's seizure advisory system, which was a system that allowed patients with epilepsy to actually, it would notify them that there was some kind of brain activity that suggested that they may have a seizure. And they were able to take a medication to be able to prevent the seizure. That company also went out of business. And so a lot of these patients also lost access to these devices. Another kind of classic example is ATI, neurostimulator, which basically allowed patients with cluster headaches to be able to manage these cluster headaches, which can be, you know, extremely debilitating. So it's something that has happened before and, more importantly, will continue to happen, because we do not have any kind of regulations or laws either in the US or around the world that help ensure that these participants, the people that are making these trials possible and the progress in brain-computer interfaces and in neural devices possible, once they participate in the trial and once the trial ends, even if they benefit, let's say a patient with treatment-resistant depression, you know, gets deep brain stimulation in a trial, actually improves, gets much better with the stimulation, their symptoms of depression decrease. Trials usually last between 4 and 5 years, and the participation of the patient will usually be like a year or two. So once the trial ends, there's really nothing in our system that will help ensure that patients have access to these devices if they're beneficial. And this is one of the issues that I think is probably one of the biggest threats to neuromodulation and to the development of brain-computer interfaces and neural devices currently. We have a lot of investment coming in, but with investment, unfortunately, come failure. So many patients will lose access to the device, even if the device has been beneficial. As I mentioned, patients, let's say, with treatment-resistant depression may lose access to the device, even if they benefit from this. And there's nothing else that has been able to help them. Same thing with patients with obsessive-compulsive disorder, or the patients that Synchron or Neuralink are treating for, or are using their devices for paralysis. If these companies do not plan for post-trial maintenance of the device, and oftentimes there's no regulation or any kind of laws that require them to plan for this maintenance of the device, people will experience what we call these deprivation harms. For, you know, once you're deprived of access and the maintenance of these devices, these patients will often go back to re-experiencing the treatment-resistant condition that they experienced for many years, and, you know, have tried many different alternatives. Nothing has worked until they found these devices. So it's really important that these device developers and as a community, as a global community, that we start paying attention to the people that are making these devices possible for all of us. You know, yes, the research, the developers are doing fantastic work. The researchers are doing fantastic work. And this is something that could help a lot of patients. But in the meantime, in the process of helping these patient populations, we need to make sure that we take care of the participants in these trials. So we need to figure out some kind of policies, regulations, laws that will help ensure that device developers continue providing the maintenance necessary for these devices until they get approved, or for at least a certain amount of time after the trial.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Dr. Gabriel Lazaro-Munoz from the Harvard Medical School Center for Bioethics. Gabriel, you mentioned that there's no current regulation. From an ethical perspective, what are the principles that should apply here? And to what extent has there been initiative to try and actually implement regulation in this space?
there's been increasing awareness of the issue, but there has not really been a lot of concrete efforts to try to ensure that patients do have access to these devices if they benefit from them. One of the studies that we have right now that's funded by the National Institutes of Health is trying to identify potential solutions, get stakeholders, insurance providers, researchers, device developers, patients, get them together to try to identify potential solutions and ways that we could help promote access to these devices. In the US, one of the big challenges is that once the trial is over, the patient wants to maintain the device. They may go to their insurance provider and request that they cover the cost of maintaining the device, but the insurance provider can claim that this is an investigational device, so it's not medically necessary. So in places like the US, where you depend on health insurance to be able to cover the cost of this maintenance, and many patients do not have the wealth to be able to pay for the expenses without health insurance, you may be in a situation where you have to pay out of pocket. That's if the company is still in business and still producing the hardware. But there may be many companies that decide that, hey, we're not getting the kind of results that we were expecting, so we're going to change the design and add some other feature that makes the new design incompatible with the design that's already implanted. Or they may decide that they just don't want to invest in this device anymore, or want to sell the intellectual property to another company. And the company who buys the intellectual property does not really have any obligation to the patients. I mean, I think they have an ethical obligation, but no legal obligation to these patients that are already implanted with some of the devices to continue providing maintenance to these devices.
And you mentioned insurance on the patient side there. Is there an obligation on those working with investigational devices, the companies themselves, to obtain insurances that might cover this sort of risk?
I think absolutely. I think these companies need to be able to find solutions. It could be insurance. There could be other alternatives. For example, in the US, you could regulate so that you can make sure that those people who are patients and participants who are benefiting from these investigational brain implants, that they are able, if they can show that, and the researchers can show that they're benefiting from these devices. We legislate, we regulate, we make sure that they get coverage for the cost of the maintenance of these devices. So there are things that can be done. The device manufacturer themselves could also, let's say, develop, could be an insurance, or it could be a certain accounts where they allocate funds in an escrow account so that participants could access these funds later if they have the financial need to be able to maintain their device. So there's different ways that device manufacturers could help manage the situation better. I think it's critical, because building trust with these participants and with your future potential customers, I think is really key.
You mentioned developers taking the initiative in this area. In your research in the field, are there examples of what you'd regard as best practice amongst private industry operators, and what are they doing?
We have conducted interviews with researchers doing these kinds of studies with participants that are part of these studies and their families, for example. One of the things that we hear from even developers and many of the researchers will try to continue providing, being available and providing services to maintain the devices. So many of the researchers who are also physicians feel like, they have a responsibility to continue some degree of care, particularly related to the device, with this patient. So they'll make themselves available, which is a challenge, and it's something very important where there's not that many people that have the expertise to manage these devices. So it's really important that the researchers are willing to provide these services. Many times the researchers will do a really good job at going through the consent forms, but there are instances where we see that patients do not even realize that they're not going to have access to the device when the trial is over.
Have you actually seen the contracts that these patients enter into?
Yeah, we have. The consent forms, it's kind of like a contract. Some people will argue that from a legal standpoint, it wouldn't be considered a contract, but it has all the disclosures necessary. In the US, we have a very disclosure heavy system in terms of consent. It's like, we need to give you a lot of information, and as long as we disclose, you know, the company should be okay if the patient is agreeing to, from a legal standpoint.
Yeah, yeah, but I suppose then it becomes an information overload problem.
Yeah, and it absolutely can become an information overload problem. And we've talked to patients before the surgery, so after they do they go through the consent process, but before the surgery, and then 6 months after the surgery, and we've asked them, hey, like right after the consent process, do you recall any conversation about what will happen with the device when the study is over? And most of the participants told us that they did not recall having discussed that, even though the consent had already happened and they were about, you know, in a few days or weeks to get the surgery. When we asked them 6 months later, a few of them were able to recall that, yes, there was a conversation about it. In some of the cases, it was the patient, after hearing our question following the consent process, would ask their clinician, hey, I was talking to this other research group, and they, you know, they asked me about this, and To be honest, I didn't remember what's going to happen with the device after the trial is over. So this is something that, as you were saying, regarding the information overload, there's so much information that you are processing. You know, you have to consider also that these are patients that some of them may have conditions where there are certain cognitive aspects that, like, you know, issues with concentration, which may happen with many kinds of mental illness. Or, you know, there may be a lot of things, even just thinking about the fact that you're going to get an investigational neural device implanted in your brain in a few days. That's enough to worry someone, right? And perhaps these patients are in a situation where they're not in an ideal moment to be hearing all of this information and be processing all of this information. So we need to be better about how we present the information to make sure that they understand what the implications are. It's something that needs to be done throughout the clinical research process. So at the beginning, you definitely want to make them aware of what are the main issues and the things that could have important implications, such as the fact that you may not have access to the device or the maintenance of the device after the trial is over. One of the reasons why I think there's a lot of value in it from a device developer perspective as well is that right now we're very focused in this field on identifying brain regions and developing different devices that help manage certain conditions. But we're not really thinking or studying as much what happens long term. And these devices, for most people, are expected to be implanted and remain in these people for the remainder of their lives. We're talking about devices that are not intended to be used for a year or two or a couple of years. We're talking about devices that may be used for 30, 40, 50 years. So we need to start also understanding what happens long term. You know, how does the device respond in the brain? You know, 5 years from the point that you implant that device, what happens 10 years, 15 years from now? What happens with the battery? All of these things are really key to the uptake and the success of these technologies from a commercial standpoint, but also for the well-being of these participants that are making the science possible. If we're having trouble with the larger companies, I think when we start seeing more of these smaller companies get into this space without the level of capital that these larger companies have, and they're still not providing, you know, maintenance for these devices, I think we're going to see a lot more failures, a lot more companies just, you know, going out of business or changing designs. You know, it just creates a very difficult situation for these patients.
Yes, in one sense, these sound like very familiar issues for any consumer of any sort of technology, but it's in an area where the stakes literally could not be higher. Dr. Gabriel Lazaro Munoz, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
And we were speaking there with Dr. Gabriel Lazaro Munoz, who's a neuroscientist and bioethicist at the Harvard Medical School Center for Bioethics and also a co-director of the Neurotech Justice Accelerator at Mass General Brigham Hospital.
Think bigger about the world we live in. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.